This is WRTI, and this is a special interview that we're presenting to you today. I'm Spencer Weston, a kind of guest. I guess I could call myself a fan of the music and, of course, a fan of WRTI. Whenever we think of the best in creative music in Philadelphia, we always think of radio station WRTI, which emanates, of course, from Temple University in North Philadelphia. Also, I'd like to recognize Vince Thomas, who is the station manager at RTI, for putting together such a fine array of music. The reason that I'm here today is to talk with a creative black musician who has a great deal to say, who has been involved in the music for at least, I guess, 25 years. We'll talk about that in a minute, his early involvements. We're talking about Ken McIntyre, a saxophonist, reed player, instructor, composer, writer. And I first became Ken back in the early 60s, aware of Ken McIntyre's work in the early 1960s. At that time, he was working with musicians such as Eric Dolphy, Booker Irvin, and many of the people that were doing different kinds of things with the music back then. And I suppose that period and the movement that Ken McIntyre was associated with was called the avant-garde, a new thing, and it was a period of black music history in which the critics seemed to come down hard on many musicians and also, in some cases, ruin the careers of, I think, many beautiful musicians through the lack of critical acclaim. And I'd like to kind of open the conversation on that point with Ken. I'd like to welcome you to Philadelphia and just ask you, how much do you think or do you feel that the critics have an impact on the development of black music?
Well, Spencer, first I'd like to say I'm delighted to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I want to answer your question, but I would also like to have our listening audience have a better, a little more information regarding what I'm doing,
okay.
I've been into. I say that because many people may not be aware of some things that I'm doing or may not even know who I am. And I'd like
to... In fact, that's one of the reasons I think that we're here, to try to illuminate that kind of information, the fact that you are a major creative force in music very few people know who you are or have ever heard your music or could care less about it. And I think that's the kind of right that we're trying, the kind of wrong we're trying to
right. I'm one of those well-kept secrets.
Mm-hmm.
I'd just like to say, so I can get into exactly the critic question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a director of performing arts at the State University of New York. I created a program there. It's the only African-American music program that offers a degree. You can get a Bachelor of Arts degree. This is at the SUNY State University of New York College at Old Westbury. I've been there for the past 10 years. I created the program, and just recently we've gone into performing arts, which combines African-American music, dance, and theater. Now, when we say African-American music, we're talking about the music that was created by the African slave in America. And that includes the terms that many of us know, such as blues, jazz, swing, boogie-woogie, bebop, crossover, new thing, funk. All these terms come out of the African-American experience in this country, and I think it's important that we understand that. Prior to coming to Old Westbury, where I've been for the past 10 years, I taught elementary school, junior high school, senior high school in New York City. So one might say I'm an educator. Yes, I've been wearing that hat for a long time. I've also been recording. I've got, right now, I've got 9 albums on the market, and I see you have a couple of them here, Spencer. And they go back to 1960. And having said all of that, I'll move to your question with regard to the critics. The album you have here, one of them, he has Looking Ahead with Eric Dolphy on it. Eric Dolphy died in 1964. Fantastic musician. The critic in Downbeat magazine started off the review of that particular album with, "Don't listen to this album if you have the slightest hint of headache." He went on to talk about our libido Then he went on and called us the terrible twins, and in summation stated that he thought all in all, it's not a bad album, and out of a 5-star rating, he gave the album 2.5 stars. And I was shocked because he didn't deal with the music. He went off on some kind of tangent, but as a result, of course, Eric was very excellent musician. He had won the polls in he was winning polls in 1960, 1961, 62, because he was excellent woodwind player, excellent. And he was winning awards, but he wasn't getting any work. So when that review came out, I can remember saying to my wife, well, I was working downtown and in Manhattan, and I think I worked a few hours, and the guy gave me a couple dollars or something like that. And I went home to my wife, and she said, well, how much money did you make? And I said, well, I think I got a couple dollars, but it will be better tomorrow night. My wife said, there'll be no tomorrow night. And I might just well confess that I had 2 degrees in my pocket. I had a master's degree in composition. I didn't give you my formal education, but at that time I had a master's. So my wife said, no, you don't need a master's degree to go and work for $2. And she was right. So I went to Manhattan School of Music and took some education courses, and that's when I got into education. Eric subsequently went to Europe, where he died because of an attack that many people were not aware that he had sugar diabetes. Yeah, mm-hmm. And they thought that, well, he's a musician, you know how those musicians are. They're on drugs, and so he's a junkie, and he's in the corner, and he died. Mm-hmm. One could say many deaths are unnecessary. That was unnecessary. So when you ask about the critics, I would say, unfortunately, they wield a tremendous amount of power, and it's in part because our people have been alienated from the music. They've not been able to tune into the music to deal with it. Consequently, they listen to what the critics have to say, people can listen to music and determine for themselves whether they like it or not. And this is what I try and encourage people to do. Never mind what people say. If the music speaks to you, then it says something. And if it doesn't speak to you immediately, that doesn't mean that it's not good music. It may mean that you're not ready, perhaps, to deal with it. And just, may I speak a little bit? Yeah. I'm reminded of myself. I heard perhaps the greatest musician I ever heard in my life on record when I was a youngster, and that was Charlie Parker. I had 3 friends. They said to me, hey, we want you to check out this music. So they played some recordings. These were 78s, and they were giggling, and they had not been exposed to any no-name cigarettes or hadn't been drinking anything. They were just listening to music and giggling. Mm-hmm. And I said, man, what are these? I said, these cats are crazy. And they kept listening and saying, oh, man, dig that, and they'd whistle parts of it and so on. And it sounded like nothing I'd ever heard before. I made no connection. So I said, now, wait a minute. I grew up in the same neighborhood with these cats. We're buddies, blah, 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 mm-hmm. blah. So I said, let me listen to this music. So about 45 minutes for the next 5 days, I went and listened to this music. Went down to my buddy's house and turned on his record player and listened to the music. And about the 5th day, I heard what Bird was playing. And I might add that the 3 fellas, one is dead now, one is a high-powered salesman, the other one is an English professor. So in other words, they didn't even go into music. Mm-hmm. I went into music. And I went in because I heard sounds, and I heard messages that came through to me from Bird that were very, very unique. In essence, it was a presentation of a very personalized style, but was very powerful and had something to say. And it was that message that I got as a result of listening to Bird. So I'm saying that I'm a musician, and I've been considered, getting back to something Spencer said, in the avant-garde, which is a term that doesn't do any good. It just alienates people, turns them off. I've been put in that camp, and I never saw myself in that particular camp. So the point is that it took me a long time to get, I'm saying, 5 days of constantly listening to Bird in order to get to it. Nowadays, people want to hear music, and if it doesn't hit them over the head, like, bap, mm-hmm. they don't listen.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's really killing a lot of interest in the music, is the fact that the music that is popular gets marketed on such a high-powered level, and there's so much hype behind it that people refuse to listen. I can remember when I was coming up, we would just buy records with sometimes people we didn't know. We might recognize maybe the rhythm section, but we knew if that rhythm section was with those horn players that they had to be top-flight horn players, you know, and that kind of openness we had about the music. Whereas now, I think music has gotten more into style and marketing and the kind of clothes you wear and you know, the disco kind of thing. And also, you mentioned something else that I want you to kind of speak about a little bit, and that's the fact that music was 20 years ago, 25 years ago, quite accessible to the black community. And now, for the most part, there is no real creative music in the black community.
The program, when I was a youngster, we could go into a record shop and listen to records. Mm-hmm. We could go in, and they had several booths, and you could take maybe four or five records. These are 78s. You'd go in the booth, and we'd go in there maybe three or four strong, and we'd crowd in the booth. We might take 10 or 12 records in there, listen to them, and just get down and say, yeah. And, of course, we'd take about 10 or 12 records in, but we'd come out with about maybe four or five, because the rest would be on our coats, on our belts. And in this particular store that we used to rip off, I mean, we had the best record collection, I think, in town. And this cat still made money. I mean, he didn't go out of business because of our ripoffs. Mm-hmm. And so the proprietor. So we had a chance to listen to records and then make our choice. And we'd buy one or two, but we'd liberate more than we bought. We had the opportunity in those days of listening to Symphony Sid, who used to come on Friday nights and Saturday nights here in New York. I'm from Boston. And we used to sit up and listen to him from midnight until like 5 o'clock on Fridays or Saturdays, and then from midnight till 5:45, something like that. So we'd party, and after party we'd go to someone's house and sit and listen to music. So we could listen to a lot of music. Today, you're quite right. They package it, and you only hear what the program managers want you to hear. You don't have stations. That's why it's important for a station like the university here at Temple University's radio station and university stations across the country, that they have a very, very significant role to play, in my view, in terms of enlightening audiences with respect to the music. And I think that this is, of course, a bias on my own part, that much new music as possible should be played by these stations so that audiences can begin to recognize that there is a wellspring of music that's going on that has some merit. And because a person who may be considered a, quote, avant-garde, that is a classification or a packaging or a categorization of one person by somebody else. And that doesn't mean that the particular person is what he or she is being touted as. In other words, being isolated. That is, if a person is avant-garde, then that means that he cannot play, to use some of the other terms, he cannot play swing, or he cannot play bebop, or he cannot play rhythm and blues, or he cannot play funk. That's not true, because all of this comes out of the African-American experience. It's not a segmented kind of situation as it is presented. Certainly, in my era, when we grew up, we danced to, many people are amazed to hear this, we danced to Bird and Bud and Max and Mingus, and we danced to Thelonious Monk because they would come through. We danced to that music. There are many people that never danced to that music. They claimed they could only dance to rhythm and blues. Now, we danced to rhythm and blues at that particular time, and we danced to bebop. Those are terms that one might know. And what happened, as a result of so-called bebop, many people said they couldn't dance to it because the beat was a little more sophisticated. The drummer was not hitting you over the head like they do in rhythm and blues, which became rock and roll, and now many people call funk. The beat is still there, but it's not as heavy because one made an assumption that you were sophisticated enough to get to that music without it being hit over the head. But now, we're so retarded that the music that they put out there is bap, bap, bap. Here it is. Get down now, right now. And we say, oh, man, that's boss. Now, there's nothing there, but we're being hypnotized by the beat, and we're responding to it. And I'm not saying that we should not deal with that, because that's part of it, too, but it's not the entire spectrum by no means.
This is Spencer Weston, and this is radio station WRTI, and we're conducting a very special interview with a creative musician by the name of Ken McIntyre, a woodwind player, a teacher. A man about many accomplishments in music, accomplishments which probably are unaware to you. Ken, I'd like you to kind of continue on, you know, since we've opened up that question vis-a-vis black music, it's kind of almost complete isolation from the black community, especially many of the younger people in the black community. And this is something that you hear from many musicians. They all talk about the lack of participation of black people and the fact that music is coming away. And of course, the obvious question is, what can we do? How can we get more people involved in terms of criticism so that the fragmentation of black music doesn't occur? Because anybody that really looks at the music from the point of view, an Afrocentric point of view, you can hear the connections and the continuity in the different styles. Something might be avant-garde, but you can also hear the early blues in it, and something might be bebop, but you can still, of course, hear swing in it. And how can we get people to understand and to look at music from a perspective that is more in line with the aesthetics of the music itself?
Essentially, what you're talking about is a concept of a communal concept. In African societies, music was and is an integral part of the society, and everybody participated in some way or another. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, in this society, we've been fragmented. We've not been in contact with ourselves, with each other in that regard. One way to do it is through education, and not necessarily formal education. If you have a group that's performing, ask them to if they would allow for some discussion while a concert takes place. Now, you may put the musicians on the spot, because many of them may not be articulate enough or may not have thought through what it is they're doing. But nonetheless, that attempt should be made. In other words, some dialogue with the musician and the audience, because what has happened is the musician is continuing to create his music, and the radio station managers and people who control have been saying that, well, the music is avant-garde. It's ahead of the people. And I argue that the music is not ahead of the people, but rather the establishment is attempting to retard the people, so therefore they give the people music that has existed for 50 years. In other words, they mummify, as Frantz Fanon said in one of his books, Wretched of Youth, that they mummify the art. That is to say, that they feed you something that's 25 or 30 or 40 years old. They keep feeding you the same thing because they know what your response is going to be. What I'm saying essentially is that if one were to listen to some more music than what one hears on every station, say on AM, that one may begin to think a little differently, act a little differently, and, of course, this would be contrary to what is expected by the people who control, because we are expected to, when we hear music, we get up and we shake our skin, and we may bounce around a little bit, and we may smoke some no-name cigarettes or drink some alcohol, and then jump in bed with somebody, something like that. And then we keep repeating that, et cetera. But There are factors, there are redeeming factors in music that can move us to another level. And if we begin to try and talk with musicians and in performance and even outside, where we can, so we can begin to bridge the gap, because the musician is the same as everybody else. It just that he spends more time expressing himself through his instrument rather than words. And here's where we have a problem, because there are many musicians who don't like to talk. They have bought into the notion that, well, I play music and my music speaks for me. Yes, your music speaks for you, yeah, but at the same time, there are some people that need to hear words in order to get to the music that you're speaking about. And this can become a problem for many of us who see ourselves as artists. And as an artist, well, I don't have to talk. And I think many of us go through stages of that, which is very detrimental, because while we remain silent, then somebody else speaks for us and passes out misinformation, and we don't say anything. Right. So then they're dictating and controlling what it is that's going on because of our silence. Yeah.
It's very interesting that you mentioned that concept of having musicians to, when they are playing or performing, to, you know, to say a little bit about what they're doing, or maybe field a few questions from the audience, because in Philadelphia, we're fortunate to have a program called Jazz Talk. It's a nonprofit organization called the Train Stop Resource Institute, which is about perpetuating black music. And Train Stop presented, I think, over 25 concerts and lectures, and they had musicians from mostly around the city to come in and to perform and also lecture. Mm-hmm. And these were around the city in the different sections, North Philadelphia, the series at Temple, at LaSalle College in the northwest part of the city, at the Free Library. And it was really a fantastic series, because you could hear people such as Philly Joe Jones talk about, you know, his playing, his experience, some of the things that he does when he plays, some of the drummers that influenced him. Very good turnout for Sun Ra talking about his music, his vision of the world, and how music is a part of that. Mitty Middleton, a local tenor man, gave a very excellent presentation. And so musicians, you know, I think will speak and can articulate their feelings and their perspectives on the music when they're given that kind of form, because the music was presented in an atmosphere that put the music on the level that it should have been. It wasn't just some background music to buy some drinks or to talk to someone or something like that. Music became the central subject matter in the whole thing, and people came out just to hear the music. Now, of course, not enough people probably came out, and we're hoping that next year, even more people will gravitate to this particular concept of coming out to enjoy music and also to learn something about it, because, as you know, it's not presented in the public schools. We don't hear it on the radio, so it's just something that we're going to have to do more and more ourselves, and we're going to have to utilize these kind of outlets such as RTI, and we're going to need black people that know the music to write about it and put out independent publications and that type of thing.
You're really touching on some very vital points, namely that the African American has created this music and has presented it, and continues to present it and create it, but controls very little. Mm-hmm. The record companies, the managers, producers. The powers that be, the control of the industry, is out of African Americans' hands.
Most people don't understand. Maybe you can explain this to listening audience. Most people don't understand why it's difficult to put out a record independently or on a small label. Why is that so difficult for, you know, because there have been several musicians who have their own labels, and it would seem to me that, you know, all musicians would get together and say, well, this is going to be our label and we're going to put it out. What's the difficulty in doing that, Ken?
The difficulty in putting out your own album is distribution. You can go in a studio and put out a fine product and get a fine jacket. You'll pay for it yourself, but the distribution is a problem. You have to find someone that will distribute it for you. And if no one distributes it, then you have to try and do it yourself. And you can't do very much that way. Mm-hmm. In terms of a collective, we've had a collective that unfortunately did not fare too well for everyone that was involved. The people that were in charge became kind of greedy and did not level with the musicians that were involved, so that was not a very good venture. There have been several ventures over the years where African Americans have attempted to deal with...
Was that the Strata East record?
Yes, yes, right. Yes. Attempted to deal with the putting out of the record. But it hasn't worked. It can work if we could get to African Americans in the community who are in different fields. For example, there are professionals who are in education, in medicine, in law, in all walks of life, who have some money, and but unfortunately don't seem to view the culture as something worth saving. And I'm not saying that once you try and save it for altruistic reasons, but I'm saying that you can it's a both-and situation. You can save it and make money at the same time, because there are people, the European Americans who control this make a tremendous amount of money. The industry, African American music, is a multi-billion-dollar industry, and just to say that in and of itself may be a little vague, and how I want to kind of put it in a context so everyone can understand. The multiple percussion set, or more commonly known as the trap set, came from the marching band. It was an African American who took the snare drum, the tenor drum, which is a floor tom, and the bass drum, which we all are familiar with, and fashioned a one-man operation. They took the cymbals, put them on a stand, so we had a sock cymbal. So we have what took four men to play the so-called slave, who was, I must say, was considered chattel, was considered three-fifths of a man, was considered subhuman. He fashioned this into a one-man operation. So that says something about the so-called chattel, the so-called three-fifths of a man, the so-called subhuman. So now, the trap set, the multiple percussion set, that epitomizes African-American music. So anywhere that you find that set, you find music in the African-American tradition.
Exactly.
And you can find it in symphony orchestras, because when a symphony orchestra decide to use it, you can find it in Lawrence Welk, for example. You can find it. So I'm saying that this comes out of the African slave experience in America. And if we could begin to realize that and see how many people have ripped off from it and diluted and diluted and diluted, but they're all making money except the people who have created it.
I think one of the things that we fail to perceive as a people that that our culture, and especially our music, is a natural resource.
Ooh.
It's probably, it's probably our biggest resource as a people, and it's something that we allow to flit away.
It's akin,
without, you know, controlling it or even attempting to defend it at all.
It's akin to the minerals in South Africa.
Right.
Where
right.
They're going in those mines, going and pulling it out, and they're doing the same thing here, because you turn around and the African American is coming up with more and more and more and more, and getting less.
You look at popular American music, and there would be no popular American music as we know it today unless there was black music.
Yeah.
All the forms, all the people that make all the money, and
no argument. No argument.
Yeah.
And so that we can understand that I'm using, one could say, well, they're fantastic trumpet players, or they're fantastic saxophone players or something. But that may be abstract for folks. But when you see that trap set, in the slave experience in the United States, the drum was taken away from the African American. Now, in the Caribbean and in South America, the African drum exists in the Caribbean and South America. It does not exist in North America, because it was taken away from the slave in North America. So the trap set is really what epitomizes the music created by the African slave in America, that particular instrument.
We've been speaking with Ken McIntyre, reed man, a professor at Old Westbury in New York on Long Island. I believe it's on Long Island, isn't it, Ken?
Right.
And Ken is truly a master musician, a master in the idiom of black music, classical black music, and very glad to have him down today, and really touched on some very salient points. And I'd like to have you back again, perhaps to talk about your role in education and how education can play a role in the music, because that's something we didn't touch on, which I think is very important. But for now, I'd like to say, this is Spencer Weston, who is kind of guest hosting on WRTI. I'd like to say thank you to Ken McIntyre. Thank you.